What's up, guys? Welcome to the Behind the Deal podcast, where we explore growth through acquisition. Whether you're a private equity fund manager looking to expand your portfolio or a business owner aiming to scale and build lasting value through acquisition, each of our episodes will break down the strategies, stories, the lessons that make acquisition one of the most powerful paths to growth. I hope you enjoy. All right, guys, on today's episode of Behind the Deal, I feature Guillaume Lozado. Guillaume is a partner at the SaaS Group. The SaaS Group has been around acquiring software companies, you know, for over a decade now. They have a pretty specific moat in product-led software companies. And, you know, they've been able to do, you know, they have 23 portfolio companies right now. They have a strategy where they're buying and holding these businesses. So, you know, you'll find out from just listening to this episode that, that brings a whole unique, different way of looking at opportunities to the spectrum rather than just buying something traditional private equity route and, you know, looking to grow it and resell it. You know, these guys have to take a pretty different approach when they're buying something and looking to hold it for the long term. So, you know, Guillaume and I cover a number of different topics, and, you know, he's been a great guest and, you know, shares some really cool insights here. So I hope you enjoy this episode with the SaaS Group. All right, everybody, welcome back to the Behind the Deal podcast. My name is Joe Zanke, your host, co-founder of DealGen Partners, who sponsors our show. And today I'm with my guest, Guillaume Lozado of the SaaS Group. Guillaume, what's going on?
I'm all good, Joe. How are you today?
Doing great, man. Doing great. I was admiring those movies behind you. A lot of good classics there. And I just really like the setup. I appreciate a good video call setup. And you, my friend, you have one.
Yeah, well, it's actually always a nice icebreaker with some founders that are into cinema. So yeah, for sure, I've kept this for 4 years. Maybe I should change some of the movies there, but I mean, these are classics, right?
I don't know. You'd have a hard time figuring out which one to take off the wall.
For sure.
So look, before we get into some questions and stuff, I want to give you a second here to talk about, you know, yourself and the SaaS Group, and you know what you guys do and what you're all about.
Sounds great. Yeah, absolutely. So there's a lot to say about SaaS Group, but first, maybe a couple of words about myself. So Guillaume Lozado, thanks for not butchering my name, Joe. I'm French, but I'm based in the UK. I've been based in Liverpool for about 13 years now. And actually, SaaS Group is a very international company, right? So they've got people in 50, 55 different countries. We're remote first. So, you know, you'll see a lot of people like me that are from one country and living in a different country, or, you know, even moving from one country to another. It's a great culture that we've got at SaaS Group of people kind of, very, very open to moving internationally and experiencing different cultures. I'm part of the M&A team at SaaS Group. So I lead the origination team. Basically, I have a team of three originators that are spending their day and myself talking to founders of SaaS businesses, trying to understand where they are in their journey. And if at some point, you know, an exit would be considered, and formalizing the conversation a little bit more towards this direction. And SaaS Group itself is a group that was founded in 2018. Our roots are very much in Germany. Our founders are all German. The CEO, his name is Tim Schumacher. He's a very well-known entrepreneur in the DACH region. He really started out of university's first business in 1999. It was a business called Sidoo.com, which is a domain marketplace that he grew, he scaled up for like 10, 12 years before exiting it very successfully. He did the same thing again with another business called IO.com, which is behind a product called AdBlock Plus, a famous ad blocking platform. He realized after all those experiences that what he really loved, rather than building a product and go from zero to one, was scaling up and go from one to 10. And so this idea came then when he partnered up with a few other founders that did exits, and he created SaaS Group to be the home for, you know, small innovative SaaS businesses that really did that, built a great product, maybe went from zero to one to two, but needed help to, you know, go further and reach 10 million and plus in ARR. So that's the kind of the origins of the story. Since then, we've done 25 acquisitions. We actually just closed one yesterday.
Congrats.
Another one a couple of weeks ago. So it's been a very busy summer of due diligence for us. We've been very busy. Nice. We have now 23 brands in the group. We have roughly almost, I want to say, 400 employees in the group, as I said, very distributed across the world. And we operate on a very decentralized model. So meaning that we acquire 100% of those companies. We keep them as standalone businesses most of the time. Sometimes we may merge them, but most of the time we keep them standalone. We keep the brand, we keep the team. And we are very founder friendly, kind of depends, you know, what the founders want, if they want to stay, if they want to exit. We'll basically design something that fits their needs.
Awesome, man. That sounds like a great strategy and, you know, good momentum going on over there. So, you know, when you guys are valuing a SaaS business, I know, you know, a lot of the times I'm talking to private equity investors, you know, they're looking maybe for more traditional businesses. They're valuing those on the EBITDA of the company. Are you guys more ARR focused than EBITDA, or in ARR is recurring revenue for anybody that doesn't know, annual recurring revenue, or are you guys doing more of an EBITDA valuation too? How do you approach that?
Yeah, that's a good question. And you'll see different models there. I also worked for one of the pioneers in the space, which is Constellation Software, and they have a little bit of a different model as well. But we work based on an EBITDA multiple, okay? And the reason why is because we're part of these kind of Everfield, evergreen type of acquirers that, you know, are keeping businesses forever. And we have to reinject all our EBITDA into our external growth engine. So we need to make sure we have, you know, long-term, sustainable, profitable growth. And so for us, yeah, the EBITDA is the name of the game. And we usually value businesses based on a multiple of the EBITDA that would be aligned with the growth of the company.
Got it. And that's a good distinction you just made, right? Because someone, you know, who's buying software companies and doing more of a recurring revenue valuation, you know, their strategy is more than likely going to be to retrade that business again at some point, whether it's, you know, 3, 5, 7 years down the road. Their goal is to grow, you know, the recurring revenue as much as they can and then retrade that. But if you're going to be holding it forever and have no, you know, desire to retrade it, then, you know, you have to make sure that it's profitable and you can just continue to focus on, you know, growing and sustaining that profit. So there's just different strategies that go into it, but it sounds like you guys definitely have yours figured out. So from a deal sourcing standpoint, right, what are the biggest challenges today in sourcing attractive software acquisitions? I know over the last 5 years or so, you know, valuations have kind of, or call it even 8 years, right? Pre-COVID, you know, software valuations kind of sky high. You know, going to COVID, going to the last 3 or so years, you know, valuations have come down, but founders, you know, are still kind of hitching themselves to, you know, what maybe other companies got, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7 years ago from a valuation standpoint. So what are some of the biggest challenges that you guys see in that space when it comes to sourcing?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. As you said, there's been a lot of movements on the market over the past, you know, years or so. I think one of the biggest things that you didn't mention is the competition, right? I think that the space is becoming more and more competitive. You know, when I started back in 2020, you know, founders would not be so used to they are now to talking to potential buyers. Right now, it feels like it's, you know, it's became almost like a weekly competition between all the buyers to kind of reach out to those businesses out there. So high level of competition, whether it is from, you know, PEs, from strategic, or from companies like us. Again, I mentioned Constellation Software a couple of minutes ago, but, you know, when they started back in the 90s, they were the pioneers in those roll-up aggregators, and now there's probably hundreds of, you know, copycat like them, doing very similar thing in in vertical market. I think the strength that we've got at SaaS Group is that we are focusing on a segment of the market that is very specific, which is the product-led growth SaaS businesses. Those self-service businesses that, you know, don't necessitate a huge sales and marketing team and can just, you know, sell themselves through a marketing mechanism and a self-service model. And in this specific market, I want to say there's not so many, you know, specialized competitors. So we really have, you know, something different there and a good differentiator. But yeah, it's always hard to also educate the founders on what the competition is, the different type of acquirers out there, and why they are hearing different models of valuation. You know, as you said, ARR, EBITDA, recurring revenue, etc. And why the price might be different from one buyer to another. Right. So there's this. I think there's also additional challenges today with AI, for sure. It's something that we are embedding more and more into our early due diligence process. And that kind of narrows down our ICP a little bit more, because now one of the first things that we are thinking as an acquirer is, you know, is this potentially AI commoditized? Or, you know, have they actually really properly embedded AI into their workflow? Does it become a moat, or is it more of a threat? And this is some distinction that we need to do as early as possible, because yeah, we're under a threat where the business can churn, you know, like that very, very quickly with the competition of AI. And so it's something that sometimes makes us kill deals very early on that we wouldn't have before.
Got it. Well, you mentioned a couple things there, you know, and one specific thing that I think is your unique advantage. The competition has gotten a little bit out of control. You know, there's so many people who are getting into the space of buying businesses, private equity, but, you know, your distinct differentiator is that narrow focus, you know, because our company is the deal searcher. That's what we do. We find opportunities for PE funds. And whenever someone approaches us with, you know, like, hey, we're kind of agnostic, you know, in the sense of like, we'll buy, you know, manufacturing or industrial companies, you're not giving yourself much of an advantage there, right? Because that's such a broad thing. Or, you know, in your case, we buy software companies. It's like, okay, well, what kind of specific software? Because that gives you the ability to not only narrow your focus on the types of companies that you're going to chase down, but also, you know, be able to distinguish yourselves when you're having those conversations and let them know like, hey, we know this product-led space, you know, better than the next guy, right? So if you're having conversations, you know, two or three times a week with potential buyers and someone's just saying, you know, yeah, we like to buy software and this is our background, you guys can say, you know, not only do we buy software companies, we buy product-led software companies. We've done this, you know, we have 23 portfolio companies. Here's some stats on how we've grown those. Here's our approach to leading this product-led growth. This is why we're the right acquirer for you. And that narrow focus and kind of distinction, I think, is what separates, you know, some of the best acquirers from maybe the rest.
Yeah, no, 100%. I think, you know, there are three questions that we kind of ask ourselves very early on when we think of acquiring a company, when we talk to a founder is, should we buy that company? And for that, I think we're just looking purely at the KPIs, the financials, and trying to understand if it fits our ICP. Why should we buy that company? Meaning, okay, you know, is there a real product market fit there? Is it a red ocean, a blue ocean? Can we make a difference with our own, you know, central team, or applying our own marketing mechanism and product mechanism? And if we don't answer those questions, then, you know, the KPIs, the financials may still look good, but we know we're not going to be the best acquirer, and we know we may not be able to 2-3x the business, you know, in the next few years. So for that, it's easy to buy something because it's cheap or because it's got the right KPIs. But if you don't know what to do with the business, you know, it's always a risk. And we've learned this lesson a little bit by diversifying the portfolio, you know, in the past few years. But I think right now we know what we know. We know what we can grow and what we can't necessarily grow. And that's why we're trying to restrict ourselves to, you know, the stuff that we are really, really good at.
Awesome, man. Well, look, let's dive a little bit deeper, right? So you told me, you know, you guys made an acquisition as early as this week and, you know, made another one pretty recently too. So you've been very active. You know, using a specific example maybe of a recent transaction, how did you approach that conversation with the founder about acquiring their business? And, you know, how do you talk to them about, you know, making it seem like, hey, this is more of a partnership in this process than it is maybe just, you know, someone else who's just coming in and buying it?
Yeah. Very, very good question. And I think I'll take the example of the last one. So unfortunately, I can't disclose yet because, again, it was yesterday and that will disclose very, very soon the name of the company. But that's a case where I think the relationship and the long-term relationship was very important. We spoke to that company the first time back in 2022, I believe. And back then, you know, there was a few things that were maybe bothering us. I think the size was also, you know, not there in terms of respecting our thresholds. And there was a few things within the business that were a little bit of a I'd say a yellow flag, especially some things related to hardware. So we kept the conversation going without going into you know, a formal conversation. We had a couple of touch points, and then we reconnected again earlier this year. And we saw that the business had tremendously grown. That, you know, the hardware element was now irrelevant, pretty much, and that now it fits, you know, really our ICP very, very well. And so we were able to kind of keep this conversation going for, you know, 2-3 years until the company was, you know, mature enough to fit within our ICP, while, you know, also telling them what they should potentially do to be able to exit in the next few years. And so after that, we basically started a more formal conversation that took roughly 3.5, maybe 4 months maximum. I think we started this to revisit the conversation back in June and just closed yesterday. So, and we do that with a lot of companies, right?
Because
I think last time I saw the numbers, it takes somewhere between like 2-3 years on average to actually, you know, close a deal from a first conversation to you know, closing a deal. We try to be as transparent as possible so that we don't waste their time. We don't waste our time as well. You know, we don't BS. We don't boot around the bush. We basically have a valuation conversation as early as possible so that we can understand if there is an alignment. And if there is no alignment, then we tell them, okay, potentially, this is what you need to do to optimize your valuation with us, and maybe we can talk again, you know, in 6 months, 12 months, and you know, actually, believe it or not, they do listen to our advices, and it works most of the time.
I believe it. I honestly do, right? Because I think my experience is pretty similar, right? From the first time we have conversations with people to, you know, when those deals ultimately transact, it can take some time, you know, And I think, you know, for anybody, I had this conversation recently with an independent sponsor who kind of went out on their own, and, you know, they gave themselves 2 years to close a deal. Like, so they, when they left their old fund, they said, hey, I'm going to have 2 years of runway right now for me to be able to close a transaction. And I think that was, you know, very like just beautiful insight into how this world works, because the idea that you're just going to start calling companies or emailing companies and get on the phone with somebody and within 3-6 months, you know, have a closed deal under your belt is wrong. You have to nurture those conversations, you know, and we take at Deal Gem, we take a pretty marketing heavy approach to how we source deals, where it's like, we're going to cover the landscape. We're going to initiate these conversations. Sure. We'll come across people who are ready to transact today. But at the same time, you know, we want those funds, those companies and those founders who are on our list to know, you know, this group's interested in talking to you about an acquisition, whether it's today or whether it's a year from now or a week from now or a month from now. You know, we want you to know as much as you can about them and their strategy and why they'd be a good partner. So when the time is right, you know, you guys not only can start that conversation, but you can continue that conversation as, you know, you approach a position, you know, as a founder where you're more sellable, right? And you have the things in place necessary to actually make a transaction. Because that's another thing, you know, a lot of founders, they might not understand, they might be ready mentally to sell their business, but their business itself, you know, the characteristics of it may not be ready to actually transact.
Yes.
And so, you know, good investment bankers do that job up front. But, you know, when they're not being represented, a lot of the time it takes guys like yourself to give them that guidance and to give them that advice, like you said, where like, hey, if you do these steps the right way, we can, you know, help guide you along like a path in order to achieve a position where now you're ready to actually get a transaction done. And understanding that, you know, those things take time, understanding that when you find what looks like a good opportunity, you know, you can work with that founder and build the relationship where you can kind of position the business yourself so that, you know, when they're ready, you're buying something that ultimately checks all the boxes for you guys too.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, and again, the last acquisition we've done is a good example of that, because we've done this deal direct, so without any advisor there, because I think, you know, they were educated enough to understand and to prepare the business you know, long enough in advance for a potential transaction. I mean, we've got the complete opposite example of that, where the other deal that we closed 2-3 weeks ago, we actually didn't source it ourselves. It was an advisor that brought it to us, and we were not able to kind of capture this on the off market a couple of years ago. And it was great to have an advisor to help them run through the process. But yeah, I can't count how many times I've been giving advices to founders, and I've got this email ready on the M&A checklist that they kind of need to do, 6 to 12 months before they want to get ready for a transaction, and I think they really appreciate that.
Yeah, I think they should, because it's not just if they want to sell to you guys, awesome. But in many cases, if they want to transact to anybody at all and get a valuation, that is meaningful enough to them, they need to have those checklists, kind of done, and they need to understand, hey, how do I position this company so that I can actually sell it? And a lot of the times, founders don't realize, like maybe they realize, but sometimes they don't. Like so much of your net worth is tied up in the company that you're running and starting. And you want to make sure that you're getting, a fair valuation for that. And the best thing you can do is to follow checklists like the one you're talking about and make sure that, not only are the data points that need to be, corrected or just in place in general hitting, but, they're moving the right numbers too. They're paying attention to the right things. They're paying attention to the right growth metrics so that they can, ultimately have that exit and, feel good about it.
Absolutely. I mean, same thing when you sell your house, right? You clean around, you make it nice so that you can attract more buyers and you can get a higher price. And also, I think the whole process, especially on the due diligence side, is a stressful process, right? We ask for a lot of things.
For sure.
It's intrusive. And if you have your ducks, in order, it's a lot less stressful and a lot smoother than it is when, you kind of run around trying to find information and tidy information that wasn't there yet. One example is to document your code, right? This is something that sometimes founders don't get how important it is, but if we don't understand at the time of the technical due diligence where the code comes from, who's been coding it, and if there is a proper, tracking of the workflow of the developers, it can be very complicated. It can be a little bit of a deal killer, but if it is done in advance and can be done in advance, it's a very easy process.
Definitely. That's a good example right there. So talk to me about, maybe the first 100 days post acquisition, right? When you just bought a company and you're looking to integrate it into, your environment, what do you do in those first 100 days to make sure that you're achieving success? And, how does that ultimately look for you guys?
Sure. So first of all, we have a fantastic integration guy. His name is Chris, and he's doing a fantastic job on his own. By the way, I don't know how he does, but yeah, we should probably
shout out Chris.
Duplicate him. Yeah, and I would say that the integration starts, even at the time of the due diligence, right? It doesn't start when we close a deal. But what we try to do is really build a business plan with the founders at the time of the due diligence. So that we completely align on, what the business needs to, keep growing, what kind of adjustment we need to do in terms of hiring people, or maybe using our central team. We have a central team with, resources that they can pull to, help with growth initiative, this kind of thing. So we try to map this out as early as possible so that there's no surprise and it's all lined up, at the time of the signing. But the first thing that we do, typically is making sure that the central team goes in. So, we have software tools that we're using as a central team, either for HR, for finance, or for instance, one of the first thing we do, if they don't use Stripe, we will implement Stripe, within the business. So that, it gets aligned with the rest of the group and we're talking the same language in terms of finance. Then the HR team comes in. They are great at implementing enterprise grade HR tools as well, Notion, all the tools that we're using centrally there and doing a proper communication so that again the employees are not too stressed. It's a stressful process, you never know what's going to happen, so right. HR does a great job at providing this kind of transparency as early on as possible, and then we just move on by putting the things that we have to do. So for example, the deal that we acquired 2-3 weeks ago, that was a case when the founders wanted to exit, right? Short-term exit, 3 to 6 months transition. In this case, very early on at the time of the due diligence, we started the search for a new CEO for the company. And we actually found someone that helped us with the due diligence that, very smoothly moved into the CEO position and is now kind of doing that transition with the founder. So something that we need to tackle as early as possible in advance so that there is no gap in this process, and we have leaders in place that can then drive that business plan that I mentioned before, whether it is pulling a couple of resources from the marketing central team, the product central team to do this or that growth initiative. And yeah, that's typically what we do, I'd say, over the first 100 days.
Awesome. Awesome. And you, I'm sure, part of the conversations before you even transact with the founder, I'm sure that's a pretty important piece to share with them too, right? Is like, not only are we, going to buy the company for this number, but here's how we're going to make sure what you built stays intact. Here's how we're going to take care of your existing employees and the team that helped you build that. I mean, that, I'm sure that plays a pretty big role in just throughout the whole time you're talking to that founder, like they care a lot about that.
100%. I mean, one of the things that makes the difference is, how are we going to treat the team, right? Whether the founder want to remain or they want to exit the business, I've not met one single founder that told me, well, I don't care. So they'll always right. care about, one, the legacy, but two, the team. Because we're usually talking about companies that have limited resources, maybe 3, 4, 5, 6 employees, let's say up to, 15, 20. That's usually our sweet spot in terms of acquisition. So they're working very closely with them, and they're very cautious of what is going to happen to the team. So we aligned very early on that with the founder, so that they are reassured. And actually, most of the time, it's very positive. Like, again, to give you an example, we have a great benefits package in the US, for instance, and a lot of those small companies don't necessarily have that, and employees are pretty happy that. We bring into the mix some of those enterprise grade benefits that they didn't necessarily have before. So, yeah, it's usually a good process.
Awesome. Yeah, I completely agree with you most of the time. And sometimes, these sellers, depending on how successful they've been throughout their career, like that's one of the even more than price. What's going to happen with the team and everything like that after is the most important thing. I know we do some sell side transactions at DealGen, and we're dealing with a founder right now who, has made it pretty clear, like, hey, I've made a good amount of money in my life, and I definitely want to exit for the right price. But at the same time, if I'm going to exit this company, I need to make sure that the people who helped me get this far, are taken care of. And I think that's just another differentiator. If you understand that as an acquirer, that's a huge part of winning deals, is making sure that you have not only have a plan to integrate it, but you articulate that plan really well.
100%.
So you mentioned, on this call or this show, AI and that disruption, with a mixture of AI and maybe other factors, within the economy and, just overall landscape of the business world right now. Where do you see the software kind of M&A landscape heading in the next 3 to 5 years? Like, if you're a founder who's thinking about an exit, in the next 5 years, what should you be paying attention to? What areas of software, do you think maybe even have the most potential or might even get the most disrupted by something like AI?
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of people are questioning the future of SaaS, right? Is SaaS going to get eaten by AI because people are just going to build their own stuff? I'm not sure. To be honest, I think it's going to change for sure. But is AI going to kill SaaS? No, probably not. We first of all, it's a massive market, SaaS, and it's still expected to grow. I think something like 15-20% year on year over the next few years. So it's not going anywhere. And there's a reason why SaaS is so successful, right? And I think the reason is predictability, and that's what investors love, right? That's why they've been throwing billions and billions of dollars into SaaS over the past 15-20 years, because it's a great business model. It's very predictable, and there's no surprise there. So that's where I think it will potentially be disrupted, because the pure AI native tool is less predictable. We're talking about a pricing based on agents, based on outputs, based on usage base, whatever it is, but maybe with less predictability than just a pure subscription based model that like SaaS is. So I see it three ways, right? There are those early disruptors, AI first, AI native companies that are driving crazy valuations of, you know, 40, 50x revenue, where I think there's a little bit of just the pioneers of the space here are driving people a little bit crazy in terms of valuation. Then there's, you know, the SaaS businesses that manage to really use AI as a moat and properly embed it into their workflow, you know, without just doing a cosmetic plug into ChatGPT. And those guys, I think, are doing the right thing, right? Because they are really going to build a differentiator, and I think that's going to be very, very valued by acquirers in the future. And I think for those companies, you can afford the premium, right? And then there are the rest of the players that are trying to catch up, and, you know, again, maybe trying to make a bit of a fake AI differentiator, which is simply a very kind of upper layer of APIs to a third party AI tool, where there's no huge differentiator. And for these, I think a lot of investors will pass early on because they'll see the threat of commoditization of the tool, or, you know, just the fact that they're not running fast enough to catch the AI train. I think for these companies, the multiples will go lower and lower, and they may struggle. So that's the way that I see this future.
I think so too. If you can figure out how to implement it and really embed it into your workflow, you know, you'll be setting yourself. I mean, every company, you know, should be at least learning or thinking about AI in some way, you know, not as just a disruptor, as something that they can mix into how they work, because, you know, when done right, it's a true advantage. And like you said, it can command a premium. So everybody should be kind of thinking about how they can, you know, utilize the tools that are available, embed the tools that are available, and continue to grow their business. But you mentioned, you know, it's funny, I never really heard somebody talk about like the predictability piece of the business, right? And it's almost like real estate, right? Like even when, you know, the dot-com bubble was going on and people were investing in these, you know, websites-based stocks, and they were investing in digital real estate, like the same tried and true, you know, buying a cash-flowing multifamily, you know, that hasn't gone anywhere because of the predictability, right? It's predictably going to continue to appreciate. It's predictably going to continue to grow. People are going to continue to rent houses. So, you know, there's those tried and true methods and good old fashioned, you know, SaaS with that predictability. I also agree with you, because of that factor alone, it isn't going to go anywhere.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, to talk maybe a little bit more about AI and how we approach it at SaaS Group. So we have a growing AI team, part of the central team that helps both from an internal point of view, you know, building workflows that are helping us, you know, optimize our work. And I can take the example of the origination team here. You know, we do, I'd say, a very cosmetic use of AI, just using tools here and there, but we haven't got an embedded workflow, right? But what we are building right now is this kind of engine that will help us to, you know, from A to Z, scrape thousands of companies, you know, rank them, score them, and fit them into the hands of the originator, maybe, you know, saving hundreds of hours a month as a team. And that's something that the team is doing for every team and every company within SaaS Group, but also helping companies build, you know, products with AI. And that's something that every company has to do right now in SaaS Group, or else I think, you know, they're in trouble. But it's a very important piece, I think, for everybody. But, you know, I want to say one thing is that SaaS Group is ran and built by builders and not by financial people. So, you know, they're excited about this piece, you know, building products and staying ahead of the curve, and not necessarily, you know, I think SaaS Group is run very well from a financial point of view, but, you know, the heart of what we do is basically building.
Absolutely. And if you're going to buy something and hold it, you know, you have to understand that piece of the component to it. This isn't just, you know, financial wizardry where, you know, you buy something for one price, you do whatever you need to do in order to maximize the future price, and then you resell it. You guys have to think about, you know, the future of all these companies. And as we're talking about right now, the future is AI and how that, you know, ultimately gets involved and gets into the mix. And, you know, you got to stay ahead of those curves if you're going to acquire these things and hold them, which, you know, it sounds like that's just another way that you guys, you know, really do differentiate. So, Well, look, man, I really appreciate you coming on here and you know, telling us about, you know, not only your story, but SaaS Group and, you know, just giving you different insights into the software industry as a whole. This has been awesome, Guillaume. I appreciate your time. And, you know, our audience is kind of full of different founders, bankers, intermediaries who are working with founders. So whenever I put this out there, you know, sometimes I might get, you know, some people coming back and asking, you know, where they can find, you know, whoever the guest was. So where, you know, if someone's interested in having a discussion about whether it's selling their company or just getting to know you guys, where should they reach out?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You should. It's been a pleasure. First of all, thanks Joe for inviting me. Anytime, I'll be happy to join you. People can find me on LinkedIn, Guillaume Russato. They can find me on my email. It's guillaume@sas.group. Always happy to respond, to spend some time, you know, chatting, whether, you know, people are ready or not for an exit, or, you know, whether it's advisors that have that want to have a better idea of what we're looking for, that have some business in mind that they could present us. Yeah, I'm definitely the right guy to talk to at SaaS Group about that.
Beautiful, man. Well, again, I always appreciate your time, and Guillaume, it's been truly a pleasure. I look forward to, you know, kind of releasing this one, putting it out there to the world. I think you've done a good job of, you know, educating people on this landscape. So thanks again.
Cheers. Thanks, Joe.
Take care.